Hi, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. It's Wednesday, December 26th, 2018. This actually will be the last broadcast of 2018, so thanks for joining us tonight. I wanted to talk about this book for a while. I actually wanted to read it for a while because I'd been introduced to the idea of it a few years ago as an alternative to 12-step recovery when it comes to addiction. So like I do, I scheduled the broadcast, and then I went about reading the book. And I was actually really shocked at how simple it was. And I mean that as a compliment about how straightforward it was and how much it overlapped with other approaches to recovery and mental health, including the 12 steps. There's a couple of important differences, I think, that could attract individuals looking for an alternative to the 12 steps. And one of those is that it's a non-theistic. You don't have to believe in a God or surrender to a God. And that can be very helpful for a lot of people because a lot of people will have a resistance to that. It also, I like it that it's applicable generally to mental health because he talks about the idea that addiction is an exaggeration of the human condition, that it is not unlike a lot of human nature to escape pain, to want to distract yourself, to want to seek pleasure, or to numb out unwanted, painful emotions. And so he talks about it more of a continuum. He definitely introduces the idea that abstinence is a part of this program. This is not a harm reduction program. This is a program that requires, that believes that that renouncing alcohol and drugs or whatever the addiction is critical and fundamental. He does say one thing that you don't hear often in 12-step programs. He says there are some, after a lot of practice and after years of sobriety and recovery, that can return to alcohol use without it becoming a problem. And he makes the point to say those are rare exceptions. But that goes along with a lot of the refuge recovery idea, that it's not so dogmatic, that it's not so extreme. I love one aspect that he makes clear that I'll mention a little bit later in the broadcast again, and that idea that they're not done with their model, that it's ever evolving, that they expect to learn more. He speaks in the first person plural because he talks about the refuge recovery being a collaboration with others that have participated in. Of course, it's written by Noah Levine, but it is something that he considers a collaboration. So he talks about we and us more than me and I when he talks about it. He says this is the first edition or first draft, the first chapter in our work, but we expect and allow ourselves to learn more, which again is consistent with Buddhism, which is the foundation of this approach, of this idea. And there are a lot of people, a lot of approaches that are using meditation, mindfulness, and Buddhist-inspired principles in the mental health field. Dialectical behavioral therapy is an area that uses radical acceptance, the middle path, kind of embracing kind of the gray, not the either or, and also a mindfulness. And so it really does, and like a lot of Buddhist ideas or approaches, it doesn't necessarily have to be exclusive of other approaches. In other words, it can complement a 12-step approach. I know many people in long-term recovery, and short-term recovery for that matter, who subscribe to the 12 steps, AA and NA, and also find value in refuge recovery. And some even go to the meetings. So I'll give you that preamble to this to give you some idea of the breadth of things. And then I'm going to introduce you to some of the concepts and some of the foundations. I want to say, if you're watching this visually, if you're watching the webinar version of this, there's a lot of slides that are text heavy, and I'm not going to read everything. You can go ahead and read yourself, or you can buy the book or go to refugerecovery.com or .org. So with that, let's get into it. He says Buddhism recognizes a non-theistic approach to spiritual practice. The Refuge Recovery Program of Recovery does not ask anyone to believe anything, only to trust the process and do the hard work of recovery. The core philosophy of Refuge Recovery is based on renunciation and abstinence. We believe that the recovery process truly begins when renunciation is established and maintained. So like I said, it's an abstinence-based program. And he makes it very clear that addiction is not a moral failing, that there are medical contributions to it, that there are environmental impacts, like trauma, on the addict. And that it's, like I said, not a moral failing. So first of all, I'll talk a little bit about the Buddhist concepts that he bases the model on, the approach on, and then I'll talk about how they've adapted the Buddhist concepts. Buddhism is the core of it are the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and so I'll mention those. The Four Noble Truths are, first of all, the truth of suffering, that all people suffer. And I'll try to pronounce these correctly. Dukkha is the truth about suffering. And then the second one is the truth of the origin of suffering. You know, where does suffering come from? It comes from our desires at times, our lack of attachment to things. It comes in all various ways. Sometimes it happens to us. Death, loss, grief, we're all in a state of grief. They talk about this. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the word there. The truth of the cessation of suffering, the idea that we can learn and practice in such a way so as to reduce or even in some cases get rid of suffering. And the truth of the path to the cessation of suffering. And that's where he talks about the Eightfold Path, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. Now, Levine has adapted it to sound something like this. In step one, he talks about, he doesn't call them steps, he calls them truths. He says, we take stock of all suffering we have experienced and caused as addicts. And there's a lot in the work that sounds a lot like the fourth and the fifth and the tenth step, right? Making an amends and practicing daily to recognize how you've hurt other people in your addiction and how there's a real wonderful emphasis that I identify with, where he talks a lot about, equally actually, about the suffering that you cause yourself. Right? In essence, they're one and the same from a Buddhist perspective. Number two, we investigate the causes and conditions that lead to addiction and begin the process of letting go. So there's work and inventories, just like in 12 steps, that you write down a bunch of answers to questions, and then you read those to somebody you trust, a mentor, somebody that plays the role of a mentor, like a sponsor in AA, or if you have a religious leader in your life, you share that with the person you trust. So you look at yourself and you start looking at your traumas. And I'll talk about those. I'll give you some examples from the worksheet and the questions that he asks. Number three, we come to understand that recovery is possible and take refuge in the path that leads to the end of addiction. He talks about that you can recover. One of the problems that people struggle with, I don't struggle with it. I understand the dialectic, the apparent absolute in it, but some people get tripped up by the idea in AA that you don't ever really recover, that you're always recovering. Whereas even though he recognizes most people can't use ever again without their addiction being activated, he does talk about the idea of recovering from the kind of pain and suffering of addiction. In this practice, we engage in the process of the Eightfold Path that leads to recovery. So I'll talk about the Eightfold Path now. This is the Buddhist idea, much broader, not specifically, of course, geared toward addicts, but like Levine talks about, addiction in his way of thinking is an exaggeration of the human condition. So he talks about, they talk about a right understanding, right? Right thinking, right speech or communication. Think about that in terms of relationships. Right action, learning to participate in the world in the right way. You could think of substitute the healthy way, the enlightened way, the proper way. Right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. That's the old Eightfold Path, and they go into great detail in each one of those areas to teach you what it means to live this practice. Now, let's talk about Levine's adaptation of the Eightfold Path. First, understanding. He says, we come to know that everything is ruled by cause and effect. The four truths are an ongoing practice. In this step, we gain insight into the impermanent, unsatisfactory, and impersonal nature of life. Forgiveness is possible and necessary. And then there's worksheets and practices and meditation that go along with each of these ideas, these paths. Intention. We renounce greed, hatred, and delusion. We train our minds to meet all pain with compassion and all pleasure with non-attached appreciation. We cultivate generous, kind, and compassionate wishes for all living beings. We practice honesty and humility and live with integrity. You'll recognize, again, some of the themes from the 12-step work about the way that you treat others, respect others, make amends, own your part of things, owning your resentments, right? Taking a daily inventory of your resentments is a part of a 12-step practice. Very similar here. Number three, communication or community. Again, this is important. They have meetings. There's even in the back, in the appendix of this book, the structure for what a meeting looks like, how it's practiced and led. So he believes that having community is essential, integral to maintaining your sobriety from recovering from an addiction. Communication community. We take refuge in the community as a place to practice wise communication and to support others on their paths. He says that they want somebody to be sober and practicing for at least a year before they mentor other people, teach other people. We practice being honest, wise, and careful with all our communications, asking for help from the community, allowing others to guide us through the process. We practice openness, honesty, and humility about the difficulties and successes we experience. So again, there's an invitation into a sensibility that this practice helps to develop. Number four, action and engagement. We purify our actions, letting go of the behaviors that cause harm. The minimum commitment necessary for the path toward recovery and freedom is renunciation of violence, dishonesty, sexual misconduct, and intoxication. Compassion, non-attached appreciation, generosity, kindness, honesty, integrity, and service become our guiding principles. So again, just like the 12 steps, there are our core values, and you can't compartmentalize, right? It's not as if intoxicating substances, for example, in one area of addiction are your problem. That's just evidence of a way of being, a way of living, a way of thinking. That's just how it's evidenced. Number five, livelihood and service. We try to be of service to others whenever possible, using our time, energy, and resources to help create positive change. We work toward securing a source of income livelihood that causes no harm. It becomes very clear to me here with Refuge Recovery, as it does with the 12 steps, how much all of us would be benefited, how much your children would be benefited if we all lived the principles of the 12 steps, or in this case, the principles of Refuge Recovery. Because there's a humility to it all. There's a recognition of the need for growth. And there's an emphasis in Refuge Recovery of compassion towards self along the way. I talk to my clients all the time about this idea that if your parent, or anyone for that matter, had capacity, this is what it would sound like if you told them you were angry or upset or hurt. And I don't think we know that. And I think one of the areas that any parent, not just the parent of a struggling child, but any parent can get into the place of, you know, that idea that they need to be right or be the expert. Buddhism talks about, and Noah Levine talks about, the not knowing, you know, remaining a student, the virtue of the beginner's mind. And I think as parents, we lose that, and not because we're fundamentally flawed, but because we think we should or we think we need to know it all, have the answers. And it gives us a sense of kind of pseudo security and safety, that feeling. And we think we're providing that for our child. But in this work, in the work that I do with mental health, parent coaching, with your children, with clients that I meet with, there really is great strength in not knowing somebody else's truth and not being an expert on somebody else's life, on being practicing a humility about your own fallibility. Effort and energy number 6, we commit to the daily disciplined practices of meditation, yoga, exercise, wise actions, kindness, forgiveness, generosity, compassion, appreciation, and the moment-to-moment mindfulness of feelings, emotions, thoughts, and sensations. Right? The mindfulness aspect of this is going to be the key. Learning to feel. Learning to let go of feelings that we don't need anymore. We don't need the protection of hatred or anger anymore. We can feel pain. We can feel grief, hurt, loss, discomfort. Number 7, mindfulness and meditation. We develop wisdom through practicing formal mindfulness meditation. And he has, in the appendix of this book, many examples of meditation. This leads to seeing clearly and healing the root causes and conditions that lead to the suffering of addiction. We practice present time awareness of all aspects of our life, and we take refuge in the present. And then lastly, number 8, concentration meditations. We develop the capacity to focus the mind on a single object, such as the breath, or a phrase, like a mantra, training the mind through the practices of loving kindness, compassion. That loving kindness is a meditation that we teach, that we've done a broadcast on. Compassion and forgiveness to focus on positive qualities we seek to uncover. We utilize concentration at times of temptation or craving in order to abstain from acting unwisely. So, some of you may have a meditation practice. Some of you may have a prayer practice, very, very similar, very overlapping. Some have both. But these are going to be core tools, like spokes on the wheel. And that when we're in a practice where all the spokes on the wheel are evenly focused on, evenly attended to, then the wheel rolls smoothly. And when it's out of balance, it's because one or more of the spokes is not being tended to, is not fixed. There's the core idea that addiction creates suffering. Again, not just for others that love the addict, but for oneself. A wonderful focus on this that invites a lot of compassion toward the person in recovery. And I'll tell you, I have had a lot of conversations with a lot of professionals, especially since I wrote that open letter about the impact letter and the new hopes and intentions letter, that we really don't emphasize enough how the individual is suffering. And it's because they're hard to love. It's because we use anger, resentment, frustration to mask or to block us from our sense of powerlessness, our feelings of hurt or sadness or betrayal. The path of refuge recovery begins with the first truth. Addiction creates suffering. This is not a philosophy. It is a practice. It demands action. So I'm not going to read all that I've written here for those of you watching this broadcast, but I'll hit on a few. He talks about the idea of an inventory, and there's a worksheet that you can go to on their webpage. You can also find it in the book. He talks about, for example, suffering is the stress created by craving for more. List the stress that your addiction has created. How does it manifest day to day, moment to moment? The next one is suffering is never having enough to feel satisfied. How do you suffer from your dissatisfaction? And then he goes on to list several of these kinds of questions. You answer them, you write to them. Eventually, you share them with somebody else. Suffering is jealous and envy. Make a list of everybody and everything that you've been ever envied, on and on. Suffering is the anguish and misery of being addicted. What other forms of misery did your addiction create? How did it affect your sexuality, your finances, your looks? And the kind of all-encompassing one is suffering is greed, hatred, and delusion in all of its many manifestations. Then there's a whole paragraph of questions. The cause of addiction, he says, is repetitive craving. The addict is an extreme manifestation of the normal human condition, right? That's a core idea that makes it really accessible and very unshaming for the individual who's struggling with addiction and gets into this idea and this practice. It's not a lack of morality or any deep character flaw that creates addiction. It is almost always just a lot of pain and a lack of tolerance and compassion for this pain that get us stuck in the repetitive and habitual patterns of drinking, drugging, overeating, and whatever actions our addictions take. I want to just comment on that for just a moment. I think it's easy for any of us, maybe more sometimes even for the therapist, to get focused on symptom reduction. Right? We measure mental health recovery not by what people say they believe or feel necessarily, but by their symptoms. Right? So we focus on that and we miss this idea to find the source of the pain, to have some relationship with it, to make peace with it, to move through it, to let go of it. And a practice of mindfulness asks you to do that. Again, 12-step approaches speak to this without all of the what I would say beautiful Buddhist language behind it, right? It's more medical. It's more pragmatic in its verbiage. But they talk about the idea of learning to feel everything. Very similar. They talk about more about faith, whereas in Buddhism and refuge recovery, they talk about radical acceptance. Very, very similar. Because radical acceptance and faith both turn travesty and tragedy into a lesson, into value. So then there's the second truth inventory. What are your most painful memories? This is where you look at the things that have hurt you, right? The things that have happened. They asked about your memories. They asked about being abandoned, keeping secrets, violence in your home, your family of origin, history of addiction, sexual trauma, sexual abuse. And you write about that. It really is a focused and directed kind of therapy, right? This is what clients talk about in therapy, is all these things. But these systematic practices like the 12 steps, like refuge recovery, really put great emphasis on the target, because addiction is potentially lethal. And so the worried well, the people that might be struggling with anxiety, which is not pleasant, or with moderate depression, which is not pleasant, or any other host of mental health issues, in many cases, most cases, and the ones that I just said and alluded to, it's not immediately life-threatening, but addiction can be. There are overdoses. There are accidents in the car and other places. It can lead to thought disorders, to suicidality, all criminal activities, right? All of those things can be very eminent along with addiction, many addictions. Recovery is possible. The good news is that we can fully recover from our addictions. We can end all of the necessary suffering that our addictive behaviors have created. We can heal and forgive. We'll learn to love ourselves and others through the power and practice of refuge recovery or the Dharma. We are recovering a lost or forgotten part of ourselves. I love this. This is what Evoke Therapy was built upon. We are recovering a lost or forgotten part of ourselves. Some call this our true nature or our original goodness. I refer to it often as our authentic self. Within each of us is the potential for wisdom and compassion that has been obscured and buried by our craving and addictions. So like the idea of enlightenment is that we get rid of those things that are not us. Those ideas, those lessons, those traumas, those beliefs that are not us, not our original selves. And that's enlightenment. That's why enlightenment is a very painful, difficult, some say a destructive process, because we are unlearning, fighting off and killing parts of ourselves. And then in part two of the book, he goes on to talk about many stories of people that have practiced and found recovery through refuge recovery. So his idea is so that the reader knows that he or she is not alone. And then he has a whole host of meditation and mindful practices. And then it gives the structure for a meeting. And there are other resources in there too. So what's the take home here? It's an exaggeration of the human condition. It's really looking at addiction as kind of the human condition on steroids. No pun intended with the drug reference. But it is what we do, all of us to some extent. But for the addict, it becomes life-threatening, habitual, toxic. It threatens our freedom, it threatens our life, and it threatens our sanity. It relates to and overlaps with other ways of recovery. Even it's similar to the seven challenges, which some of you may have heard of, which is not really a practice as it is a way of treating addiction. Because like the seven challenges, it's not an approach that requires dogmatic adherence to certain beliefs, but rather practice in these beliefs, open-mindedness, a willingness to be asked difficult questions. It does well, I think, like the seven challenges, to avoid power struggles. Sometimes the 12 steps or those who administer it can trigger power struggles because it's so effective for so many people, and the assumption is everybody has to do it the same way. Again, I don't have that problem with it, but that's how some people react. There's more than one way, right? There's an acknowledgement in here that some people are going to be the exception. Don't fool yourself to assume out of the gate that you are the exception, but they definitely don't provoke that defense. It may be good for those who want a non-theistic way to recovery, like he says. It can appeal to those people. It offers a systematic practice, right? Step-like work, daily work, inventories, specific meditations, and it offers community, meetings, places where you can go and lean on other people who have more experience than you, and where you then, after having had some experience, can then help other people. And it's always evolving just like we are, right? There's a humility to his work, to Buddhism. Buddha, right? The Dalai Lama said that if science proves something in Buddhism wrong, then Buddhism has to change. And so there's a beginner's mind even within the wisdom of this book or those who have created it. We are aware more will be revealed. It is our hope that we have offered here a substantial and useful foundation to the Buddhist recovery movement. We have every intention to learn and grow and revise as we go. This is just our first edition. So if you want an alternative, this can be an alternative. I think that it lends itself, it complements very well. If you're a big fan of the 12 steps, you might find some of this so complementary that you, like many that I know, kind of have a dual practice. If you're put off by, or you have a loved one who is put off by the 12-step approach, this can be an approach that works for many. It also, like the seven challenges, can be used on top of other mental health practices, right? The seven challenges is just a good way to treat a client, right? It's just like motivational interviewing. It's the most effective, practical way to approach somebody with a problem and help them in a very non-judgmental way to heal. So, any questions for the topics come up? There are none yet. I'm going to go through some of the announcements. I have a new announcement tonight that I've never given, and then I'll open it up again at the end for questions. We would like all of you to attend 6 12-step support groups. Maybe I'll add to this a refuge recovery group. I think I will. Don't let me forget that, Alex. Before next week's broadcast, I'm going to add a bullet point is one of those options. We've already added NAMI.org. Go to NAMI.org to find resources and classes in your area. Here's the new thing. The Family Foundation, the Evoke Family Foundation, reached out today and asked that I announce this. The foundation has a CrowdRise campaign going on right now. There's the link there. You can also just Google it or go to their Facebook page. But this year they have given, they wanted me to share, they've given away $73,665 in grants for treatment, Evoke, Second Nature, and other treatment programs. And they've helped 10 families and have four active families that are being helped right now who've been recipients of those grants. So if you want to get a tax write-off before the end of the year, if you just feel grateful for some of this work and you want to give to those who can't afford therapy in many cases, there's a place that you can go. Follow us on social media. All these broadcasts are available on the podcast app on an iPhone. Just search Evoke Therapy Programs. Or on an Android, download the SoundCloud app and search Evoke Therapy Programs there. Or just go to the web and go to SoundCloud.com and search Evoke Therapy there. On Twitter and Instagram, you can find us at Evoke Therapy. On Facebook, you can learn more about follow us on Facebook at Evoke Therapy Programs. I accidentally cut out the next bullet point there. Go to Facebook and search for the Evoke Family Foundation if you want to learn more. You can go to our blog for new content each week. My book is available on Amazon, The Journey of the Heroic Parent. Upcoming workshops. And at our next workshop that we want all families that are current that possibly can go, the next one is January 12th and 13th. Multifamily, experiential. You get to meet some of the staff. You get to learn what your kids are learning. You can combine it with a visit to your child if your child's therapist thinks that the timing is appropriate. Contact Melanie at evoketherapy.com to RSVP or for more information. I'll be running potentially my last Finding You. I don't have any that I'm planning on running in the future. But I would be running my last one on January 20th through 24th. And Claire Madison, whom we love, is our new clinical director for the intensives program. She's going to be running the Finding You on February 20th through 24th. So those are our next two scheduled. We also have private ones available. Contact us. Contact our admissions team for more information. Michael Griffin, our therapist from Cascades, will be in Los Angeles to run that parent support group on January 6th. We do it on a Sunday in Los Angeles to help people with traffic. So 4 to 5 is a potluck and 5 to 7 is a parent meeting. I will be in New York on January 14th, 7 to 9 p.m. at CUNY. That's the City University of New York, right across from the Empire State Building in Midtown. Email Melanie at evoketherapyprograms.com for more information or to RSVP. You can go to our website to learn about individual trips for families or young adults who want to do something fun anywhere in the world, whitewater rafting, hiking, any possible adventure activity, short-term programs, think sober fun or therapy light. It's also a good place for families to have some fun and to improve some communication. All right, are there any questions that have come up? Looks like no questions for tonight. Well, I hope it was helpful, and thank you for joining us. I hope these are helpful points of contact. I hope they can help help you find a little bit about what your child is finding out about. The next one, I wanted to talk about insight, experience, and discovering the authentic self. I was thinking about the authentic self today, and I was thinking about what a lot of people think about insight and what my experience is with experiencing my own awakening in therapy and what it is. So I'm going to be talking about what insight is in therapy, what the experience is like, what experience is created, and also what is an authentic self and why don't we know it and why don't we have it. And I'll be doing that next Wednesday, January 2nd at 7 p.m. So looks like I have one comment before we wrap up tonight. We appreciate, one parent says, what we have learned throughout our son's treatment in Utah. Things remain imperfect, but he is always thinking about his life and how to improve it. His journey continues. A nice thing is that we had some tense times recently dealing with my father's estate. No need to respond. Our learning helped us diffuse a lot of anger and resentment. Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you all for taking time to learn something, work on yourself. I cannot tell you how an attitude of humility for the parent like that, which, by the way, humility comes from confidence. Humility is almost synonymous with confidence. They're not quite synonymous, but it relies on confidence. It can only be present to the extent that one feels okay with oneself. I can't tell you how impactful the humility of a fallible parent can be to a child who's struggling. So thank you for joining us for and on behalf of them. Take care, folks. I'll talk to you next week, next year. Bye-bye.